Welcome to the first episode of the World War II podcast. My name is Angus Wallace, and in the coming months I aim to cover an eclectic mix of topics related to the Second World War. If you've not heard my name before, for the last 9 years I've been co-producing the HistoryNetwork.org podcast, short or shortish essays in military history. The Second World War has always fascinated me, especially growing up with stories told to me firsthand. My aim is to release one episode a month looking at a topic that I find interesting and would like to know more about, and hopefully you will too. In this first episode, I'll be looking at one of the iconic vehicles of the war, the German half-track, the Schützen Panzerwagen 251, designed by the German company Hanomag. The advent of the tank during the First World War had created a new class of weapon, envisaged to smash the front line, allowing the infantry to rush through. In a post-war world, it was seen as an infantry support weapon, often designed to go no faster than the infantry. Advocates of the tank, such as JFC Fuller and Basil Liddell Hart, pushed for fast-moving armoured columns. But it was Heinz Guderian who brought much of this thinking together in his book Achtung Panzer in 1937. He wrote, "Now that technology can put the infantry in the armoured escort vehicles which can move every bit as fast as the tanks, it is the tank which must determine the speed of the infantry." The idea of an armoured infantry vehicle was not new. The British converted a number of tanks during the First World War to provide armoured transport, but in the post-war cutbacks, the idea had been left to languish. The Spanish Civil War had shown that in confined areas such as woodland or urban environments, tanks were vulnerable and needed close infantry support. Guderian submitted proposals for an armoured personnel carrier which would be fast enough to keep up with the tanks on all terrain, provide protection from small arms fire, and be simple and cheap enough to be built in large quantities. The chosen design was a development of an existing 3-ton artillery tractor produced by Hanomag. Few changes were needed, a new armoured shell was bolted to the chassis, machine guns added. It entered trials in 1939 and was used in large numbers from 1940. I'm joined by Paul Hilditch from the Northern World War II Association, a living history association based in the UK. Paul has a half-track, but before we talk about his, let's explore its development and use. We need a vehicle that needs to carry, you know, an infantry section of 10 men, and it needs to keep up with the tanks speeding across the countryside. Why was the half-track the ideal design and not necessarily a fully tracked or a fully wheeled vehicle?
Wheeled vehicles, their cross-country capability is poor. You know, so obviously you've got to come up with a tracked vehicle to transport the troops where the tanks were going. And the tanks would engage the enemy, and then the Panzer Grenadiers would dismount probably a kilometre from behind the front line, and then you walk or run to where the tanks needed support. So these half tracks had to have a tracked wheelbase to transport them. You couldn't compete with tracked vehicles. So I think the basic design had to be some sort of tracks on it, to keep up with the Panzers. The two front wheels, they are actually capable of steering the vehicle. And the German vehicle actually, when you went over a certain degrees, it was the tracks actually started breaking as well on one side. The actual steering was linked to the front wheels and the tracks. It was a very complicated machine, the 251, from an engineering point of view. So as the driver was steering it, the brakes would be slowing down on one side and breaking the tracks as well, so it could steer quite easily using the wheels. And I think not having a fully tracked vehicle made it cheaper to produce, and having wheels on there, so you're not having got a massive vehicle full of tracks, and it just made it a bit more maneuverable, I would imagine.
So what kind of armored protection did it provide the section it carried?
Yeah, I mean, the 251, it was armour-plated steel. The thickest steel was at the front, protecting the engine. And there was four variants of it. And as the variants improved up to the D, the armour got better. Very, very vulnerable for air attack, of course, because there was no armour on top. The 10 troops sitting in the back had no protection at all from air attack. And they suffered a lot, as the German Air Force was depleted as the war went on. And this was sort of counterbalanced by putting a MG 42 on the back of it to try and protect the half tracks against air attack, because you can imagine a rocket or a grenade or a small bomb actually inside the troop carrying bit of the half track would just obliterate the whole half track. So very, very vulnerable to air attack indeed. But small arms fire, small shells, they protect the men. No problem at all. You know, so its armor wasn't fantastic, but it was suitable for purpose.
So, and the ammo was an MG42, I presume. It must have started life with the MG34.
Yeah, it was the MG34. It was just the A actually didn't have a gun on the front at all, but a lot of the troops put some sandbags on the front and put a 34 on that, and then it evolved to actually having a purpose-built 42 on the back with the C variant. And you know, as the Germans learned from combat experience, that you know, these vehicles need protecting from air attack. Most common was a 34 on the front and a 42 on the back, and that continued right to the end of the war.
Well, two general purpose machine guns, that's a lot of firepower, isn't it?
It is a lot of firepower, especially with the 42. I mean, that's obviously why they put that on the back, because it's such a rapid rate of fire from the 42, as we know. I mean, that was very, very good against air. I think you'd be very lucky to shoot an aircraft down mine, but just its rapid rate of fire, you know, it gave it some protection. And the 34 was just a very reliable machine gun, you know, for the front of the half track. You know, and that delivered firepower as well. But you know, its main capability was the Panzer Grenadiers inside it.
What kind of speeds did they get up to?
It would be about 22 miles an hour, something like that. I mean, the OG-810 does about 30 kilometers maximum.
On road or off road?
That would be on road, and then off road, you'd probably be talking about 20 kilometers, something like that.
How is their off-road capability?
The German half track, we go over about a meter gap of a trench, something like that. You know, if you're going quite fast, it would scoot over that. But the off-road capability was very good on them.
And how were they used by the Wehrmacht?
The main objective is to deliver men, you know, with the panzers, you know, and obviously not engage the enemy within the half track. You know, you disembark, and there were very strict sort of tactical training that went on with the Panzer Grenadiers
they'd bring the tanks forward, and the half tracks would move up in support of the tanks.
That's right. The tanks would make the initial breach in the enemy line, and that would allow the half tracks and soldiers to come through at a narrow point, and then they would spin outwards in like a pincer movement, and then encircle the objective. That was the main thing, like bring a cauldron of fire down onto a village or a point where they were trying to, you know, this pincer movement all the time, outflanking and surrounding the enemy, and like a cauldron of fire, they used to call it.
Did they produce many variants of it?
There was four variants. They were called UFs, which is like versions of them. There was UF A, B, C and D. And the A and the B are very similar. You know, they were really early on in the war. The A actually had little sights for the troops in the side of the hull, but they realised they didn't need that. And then the stowage containers were moved from the front to the back as well. And then the main one that I like is the UF C, which is the one that we have, which is sort of the classic half track shape, and that was produced to about 1943. It has the classic sort of clam doors at the back, which opened in two directions. They opened outwards and bent as well. Very, very complicated to make indeed. And Albert Speer's first job was really, you know, he had a look at the half track and he took it from the C version to the D version after 1943. And a lot of metal was cut out. And if you look at the D version, it has a very, very different silhouette to the C version. The most complicated thing that was removed were the doors. You know, these very, very complicated over-engineered doors, again, that worked in two ways. Just on the D version were just two doors that just swung outwards. They weren't bent at all. They were just two flat doors, which meant that when the vehicle was moving, that they were open all the time, swinging around. And the clam doors were just vertical on their hinges and could be opened really nicely, but they were very, very expensive to produce, being armored steel and bent, you know. And Sphere looked at these and, hey, we're going to have to get rid of that, far too expensive. So it went through a major redesign in 1943, and then the D version was the version that was produced until the end of the war.
And was it just used as a troop carrier?
The Germans realised, hey, we've got a good vehicle here, and that could be used for a lot of roles indeed. You've seen one deploying the 81mm mortar, you know, in the middle of it, which made it a really good platform to transport mortars around, a firing mortar.
How did that work? Did they take out the crew seats?
No, the crew seats were still in, but a mortar can just fit in there. You know, and that was based in there. And, you know, and there's ones with like a pack on the front as well, which was excellent. An ambulance, a pioneer wagon with a bridge on the top, an ambulance. And you get ones as well for the officers with a really sort of big map area on the front. But most of the photographs you see of those are either A version or B version. They were just being converted to a control vehicle with maps everywhere and boards so you can put maps on. The newer versions, the C's and the D's, were used as frontline vehicles, yeah. So they were utilising the older vehicles right until the end of the war, the A's and the B's, but rare, of course, because they're obviously going to break down and stuff, aren't they? And this is one of the great things about the design, that they could produce the hull, and then they would think, well, what variety are we producing? Is it an ambulance? Is it the version one, which is the main fighting vehicle? And they could actually just bolt on a liner on the inside of the outside hull, the armoured steel hull, depending on what variety it was. So they decided, well, we're going to produce some version ones, which is the fighting vehicle, and then, you know, they would just basically just bolt in this liner on the inside, and then an ambulance would have different stuff, a radio car would have different as well. So it was a very, very versatile design indeed, I think.
Did they make many other changes?
The other main thing that you can pick up on the D version, which is interesting as well, the stowage containers on the C version are all nice and neat, and there's three per side, and they're all at the back, and it looks a really nicely designed vehicle. But these were quite expensive to produce. Each little one was, you know, produced and bolted onto the side of the hull.
Is this the inside or the outside?
On the outside of them, on the outside. If you look at the C version, it's got the stowage containers on the outside. So what they decided to do, the German engineers and the designers, to actually get rid of these individual storage containers and just make them integral to the inside hull. And you can open them from the outside as well. And this made the whole shell could be produced a lot cheaper, you know, in less sections of steel. And this is with the game that the Germans are in. You know, the factories are getting bombed, less raw materials, obviously, and they had to make things a lot cheaper and quicker.
And it's incredible that when Speer took control of the armaments, production peaked in 1944 when they had, you know, they really had their back against the wall when it came to factories and steel and coal and fuel and everything else.
A lot of people don't know that. I mean, despite all the bombings, production actually went up.
And that's all to do to changing with hinges and doors on things.
You're not going to totally redesign a vehicle, but it's the little changes that mount up.
I've seen them depicted in various colours. When they rolled off the production line, what colour were they painted?
German vehicles were produced in one colour. In 1943, they were produced in the dark grey. You know, the familiar German colour of all vehicles. But after that, you know, this is why we're getting back to the D version of the half track. They all came out in this dark yellow. And this is why you see German half tracks, you know, after 1943, 44, 45, and they could be coloured, you know, any design that the German troops wanted, basically, because they were operating in so many theatres at this time. It was realised the standard, although they look great and nice and Germanic, the dark grey vehicle. And, you know, you don't want a dark grey vehicle if you're in the desert. You don't want a dark grey vehicle if you're in tropical countries or in the snow or wherever. So, you know, the troops camouflage their half tracks, you know, how they saw fit. And you get this really varied design of German camouflage and some fantastic camouflage as well. You know, the Normandy camouflage comes to mind on the tanks. I mean, just this slight little camouflage patterns. And on the Eastern Front, you know, the vehicles were individually camouflaged. And I think the troops were given pots of paint to actually come up with their own sort of scheme that fitted in with the terrain they were operating in. So interesting getting colour photographs, because no one really knows what these colours were.
That's an interesting point that had never occurred to me, that they weren't not, you know, centrally organised paint schemes.
But saying that, grey vehicles were around right until the end of the war, because Germans used whatever they could because there was just no vehicles available to them. So if it was a grey vehicle, let's get it used. You know, they didn't mind. But yeah, German vehicles came out of the factory in a dark yellow, and that was again, I imagine Svea saying, you know, let's keep this nice and simple. Let's give them an undercoat and let the troops paint it.
Well, I can't believe there wasn't a department of camouflage.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you see all these models, don't you, are made, and you see pictures of them in books, but I don't know. I think a lot of it's maybe just an impression of it, you know, and, you know, this is what we perceive it might have looked like, and, you know, from these colours and the style of it, yeah. But, you know, colour footage and photographs is still rare.
If we look at your first-hand experiences, there's obviously no driver's doors. How does the driver get in?
I mean, on a C, obviously the clam doors would open and swing, you know, vertically, which are nice, as opposed to the D version, which just opens downwards. You can imagine two like bomb doors on there, and they just open downwards. The driver would go in, and the seat actually folds forward and backwards as well, the back of it. First thing they think is like the steering wheel's the wrong way round. The steering wheel is from the bulkhead going down into your knee. If you can visualize that, it's not like a steering wheel that like you're driving a car. It's actually into your body, pointing into you. So and the reason for that is it just gives you more knee room, so you can squeeze up into it a bit more. You know, so you can there's a bit more space for the driver. So it's a bit awkward, you know, when you first have that steering wheel like that. But you get used to it. So what would do, the driver would just use the handles and just swing in. Once he's on his seat, he'll pull the backrest up and then just lock it with a very simple lever. And that would just lock the backrest. And the same with the radio operator.
It sounds a very small compartment.
It is a very small compartment, and when you're doing cross country, I've actually put rubber on the top of the ceiling. You know, I mean, to protect your head, because you do bounce around, and it is tight. And when you've got 10 troops as well, and we spent a lot of time researching this, and I never ever found a photograph of how German panzer grenadiers used to sit in the half track, but we just sort of did it by experiment. I mean, when we first did it, we were all sitting there fully kitted as soldiers with entrenching tools and bayonets, and then we thought, you can't actually sit down in it with all this equipment on. So then we realized that all the equipment, you put it in the storage trays on the side of the vehicle. Panzer grenadiers didn't sit with much on them at all, because it was just uncomfortable. And then when we all got in, 10 soldiers, you usually sit in a seat with your legs, you know, together, but we couldn't fit everybody in actually doing that, you know, because you're sitting opposite the soldier in front of you. So really we found the only way that soldiers could actually fit in, and whether this was right or wrong, I've never seen a photograph of it, but you actually interlock your knees. So you got to try and imagine it's like a zip going along the center of the half track. So you're interlocking your legs going along with the soldier opposite you. And by that way, you can actually squeeze in a bit more, and just everyone fits in nice and comfortably then. And you can quite comfortably fit 5 panzer grenadiers either side of the half track on the seats.
Shows you how tight it is when you can't even get down to the center.
Very tight. I mean, they were very, very tight, but that is the only way we could get 10 panzer grenadiers in the half track comfortably. And our seats are quite comfortable on the sea, because they were actually metal seats, and they had light leather foam on the top. And we're just talking about sphere saving money on the D version. They were just wood bench seats. That was it. So that was another way of saving money as well.
You sat in your driver's seat.
Mm-hmm.
How do you drive it?
On the C version, there's a port which you can lift up on the right in front of you and to the left of you as well. So you've got two. You can peer out the front and the side.
That's for vision.
Yeah, it's like a little letterbox, and that's armored steel. When you're in a combat situation, you need to close that. So you can bolt it down and it screws down, and then there's a very, very small slit in it that you can see out of, just to protect you. So visibility is very, very sort of poor when you're locked down. Driving it, very, very big driving circle as well if you're just using the wheels. The harder you turned the circle, the more the track was breaking on that side, which has made it a very sort of complicated mechanism indeed.
I presume it has a starter button and not a key that you turn. Once you've got it started, I mean, is it all gears and just like a regular car?
Once you've got it started, you've got your steering wheel, which is hard to get used to because it's the opposite way around. You've got obviously gears, five gears, and then you've got a high and a low ratio gears as well for on-road and off-road.
Yeah, so you've still got your three pedals on the floor.
You have, yeah. There's nothing different to that. And they're not automatic or they're not pre-selective gears at all. It's exactly the same. It really is. So there'll be no problems in anybody actually driving a half track.
Would the driver be part of the combat section, or would he stay with the vehicle?
Yeah, no, that's again, it's something we've really tried to research, and we've never come up with any sort of definitive answers on it at all. And I would imagine, yes, he would, because, you know, he would have to drive it forward a bit more to pick up his crew again. So I couldn't really see him coming out, and you know, there's storage spaces for SMGs, submachine guns there, the MP40. So I think they would just be lightly armored with shorter range weapons, and the main Panzer Grenadiers, the 10 of them, they'd be armed with the, you know, the K98 rifle. The K98s would be stored when these troops are driving.
Where is the weapon storage for the rifles then?
Yeah, that's at the full the front section. There's a row of seats either side of the half track, and they're split in the middle. So you basically got four containers, and the containers just lift up like a chest, like a box. So you can lift the top off, and there's a seat with a leather sort of like quilted seat on, and then underneath there's a massive boxes for storage and ammunition, and these seats are just bolted to the deck and to the ground and the side as well. You know, we talk about these sides that are interchangeable in the half track. You know, this is all interchangeable, these storage boxes in the C version, so there's plenty of storage in there, and then down the side as well, there's really big boxes, you know, because the shape of the vehicle is like V-shaped, so that the storage is used there, every inch is used in the half track. And you see lots of photographs of half tracks where there's stuff hanging off the outside, and you know, jerry cans and just everything hanging off, fuel and water, of course. Yeah, and a lot of add-on was to actually weld on brackets for jerry cans onto the half tracks. You know, these were done out of the factory, you know, post-factory fitted by the soldiers, where they didn't think, well, we need more fuel or water. You know, let's make up a little bracket and weld it to the half track, you know, to slip them in. And these were done by troops, you know, and very sensible as well.
It's surprisingly low-sided.
Yes, it is, yeah. And to remain covered in it, you do have to sort of bend down a bit into the half track so you can't be seen. Yeah, if you're sitting bolt upright, and yeah, you can see your head, definitely. We have been experimented as well. I have seen some shots of earlier half tracks as well, where the troops are on parade in Paris or wherever, and they were running half tracks there, and all the troops are at attention in the half track, and we've sort of tried that as well. And the only actually way you can stand up in the half track is to have one foot in the center well, and then just kneel on the bench. So if you're on the left, you have to put your right foot down and bend your left knee, and if you're on the right of the half track, you have to put your left foot down and bend your right knee. And that does look quite effective when you've got five soldiers standing up on either side. And you know, we just sort of photographed that and thought, oh, we'll try that. And it went very well indeed.
Are there any other drills or manoeuvres you've discovered is not quite as simple as it first would seem?
Other things we've been practicing, disembarking as well, is when you've got new troops disembarking from the half track, that's always takes a lot of training as well, because it's quite a small door to get through. And the classic one's banging your head as you get out or slipping. You know, you have to be quite agile and quite small to actually get out of the doors of the half track, which are not big at all, because there's not that much documentation and historical evidence about how these Panzer Grenadiers, and we were talking about it earlier, how did they sit in a half track? I mean, I've got lots of photographs, and I'm always interested about, you know, seeing photographs of this so we can get it as right as possible. How did they disembark from a half track? There must have been regulations, you know, they must have been trained how to do it, you know, and what sort of order did they go in, and, you know, just the general tactics. And you're dead right. Did the driver stay with them? Did the radio operator stay with them? You know, so this is all a learning thing. And it's just by doing living history, you actually, and operating the vehicle in a living history situation, you sort of learn these things, don't you? As the troops would do, I suppose, in operating in combat. Yeah, the easier ways, the shortcuts. And I've seen photographs of troops jumping out of the half track. And you can do that if you're quite fit, where you can actually jump out of the hole without going out of the doors. Yeah, just jump out. It's quite a drop, but you can do it.
How many original World War II versions are left?
I don't know many at all, Angus. Of the, I mean, the main version I'm interested in is the C version, the Wolf C. I haven't seen any original ones. There are original ones, but I don't think they run at all. So they were all destroyed after the war, of course. And I haven't got the figures to hand how many are around in the world, but I would imagine you could count them on one hand. I really do think that, as the case with German vehicles, they are so rare. Just after the war, you can imagine, I think everyone was sick of the war, and they're just bits of metal to people, aren't they? No one thought in 70 years these are going to be pretty good things to keep. They were just destroyed.
What actually is your half track then?
And this is an interesting story in itself. A lot of these German half tracks were produced in the Czech Republic as well, under the plans and the licenses, of course, for the German army. And then when the war ended, of course, the Czechoslovakia, as it is then, you got the German plans for the half track. And it was Cold War, and the Czech Republic needed, Czechoslovakia needed, you know, vehicles themselves. So what was the point in redesigning something, you know, that something is pretty good anyway? So they actually started making the German half track, and it was redesignated the OT-810. And this was produced in first plans in the late 40s and right through the 50s. And these were produced as Cold War vehicles with exactly the same idea that the Germans had for them, as transporting troops. But there's a war had moved on, and the OT-810 was NCB, nuclear, chemical and biological proofed, you know, so it was actually all sealed on the top, and it used to have air scrubbers inside, so the troops could survive if there was a chemical attack or a nuclear attack inside what was basically a German-designed half-track, which was just basically a different engine, slightly different transmission, basically the exact vehicle. And so the Czechs ran those, and then a lot of those were destroyed after the war, and there's about 100 OT-810s left in the world, that's all. Of course, a lot of them were converted into, and some people don't agree with that actually as well, into look-alike German 251s. And you see a lot of war films where, and you know, oh, that's an OT-810, because they basically haven't tried to do anything with it. And you know, and if you know vehicles, you know that's an OT-810, not a German 251.
And what are the obvious differences?
A German half track is open to the top, an OT-810 is sealed on the top. An OT-810 has little portholes that you can open on the side as well, and the hull is very different. There's no side compartments on it at all. There's no lockers down the side.
It hadn't occurred to me that's why I did wonder why they'd sealed the tops. Of course, the threat of nuclear warfare is the obvious reason to do so.
This is the big thing, and I mean, I think most vehicles, you know, have this capability to operate in a post-nuclear battlefield. So that's how the Czechs got them, and there are differences in the transmission as well, Angus. You know, and there's track brakes on the Czech one, and you know, a different engine. It's a bigger engine. The Maybach was underpowered, and the Czechs put a Tatra engine in. Tatra are a very, very famous Czech car maker. So Tatra made the engine, and it's a 13-liter V8 air cooled, massive engine. The actual engine is too powerful for the transmission. And a lot of the OTA10s did suffer from sort of transmission problems as well, because it's basically the same transmission as the German one, but the Maybach engine was less powerful than the diesel. So they weren't very liked by the Czech army and the troops, apparently. You know, and, you know, very cramped inside.
So where did you find yours?
So I thought, yeah, I fancy a military vehicle, and because we were doing Panzer Grenadiers, and you know how your mind runs away, and you're thinking, yeah, that's great, I'll do up an OTA-10. And you start looking at the prices and things, and you think, oh, heck. And then I got to know a lad in the Czech Republic, and he's quite a famous sort of military vehicle restorer now, and he's a real perfectionist with him. Yard Vortec, he's called. And I sort of got chatting to him. I met him through a friend of a friend, and I said, his only chance of getting one, Yard. And he goes, he gets a lot of his vehicles from Poland and then Russia. And he goes, I don't deal with Russia, but he'll get them from Poland. And we were lucky, we got an OTA 10, an old OTA 10, and it took 5 years to actually be reproduced to an actual perfect copy of a 251 UFC. You know, to the nearest millimeter, basically, it was totally taken back to its chassis. And it is indistinguishable from an original UFC. Yeah, and then the fun starts to be, Angus, is, you know, how do you get a German half track, an OTA 10, back into this country?
Oh, really? I thought that would be the easy part.
No, definitely not. Transporting vehicles through Germany, when I transported this, I don't know if it's different now, was very, very hard indeed. And it was a legacy from the Cold War, apparently, where they were very reticent about running armored vehicles through Germany, through civilian Germany. And so you have to apply to the German government, and you get one time slot to run an armored vehicle through, a private vehicle through, and you have to meet that. And then you've got the problem of getting it out of the Czech Republic, because it's like an antique. And I don't say you have to pay bribes, but, you know, in the Czech Republic in those days, it was very, things weren't like as efficient and as proper as they are in this country. Let's say that in the Czech Republic at that time. And I had a broker and who was helping me get it over here. And I rang him up and said, how's it getting on, William, with the half track? And he goes, not too good, Paul. I've been arrested. I'm in prison. I was saying, oh, no, what the hell, William? What's going on? And he says, yes, another dealer had reported him to the police, saying he'd been bribing some of the authorities with my half track, trying to get paying bribes. So that, and they were cracking down on bribing and corruption. So the next minute he's arrested. And I was like, oh my God, the whole thing's gone horribly wrong. But anyway, it was all turned out that he got out in the end, and it was all a bit of a misunderstanding, as we say, you know.
How do you find it to maintain? Is it difficult?
Well, it's a very simple engine. I mean, I never like to talk about how things are going okay on it, because it's touch wood time. But what happens, because it's an old vehicle in itself, it's 1951-52, so it's an old vehicle. But because it's a very sort of simple-ish diesel engine, you know, it's not like a modern diesel engine, it's a V8 air-cooled engine. So it's been overhauled as well. So, okay, I mean, it goes reasonably well, to be honest, but it's an old vehicle, you know, so its maintenance is hard, oil changes are hard on it. You know, the manual's got pictures and I understand bits of it, but you live and learn with it. You know, it's a vehicle that you live with and you end up loving, and, you know, and you learn about its little problems and its little, how it wants to be treated a bit, I think, really, yeah.
Does it take a lot of maintenance, or is it?
No, oil changes. Just running it, make sure the batteries are fine, and no, it's pretty straightforward. Just making sure it's all nicely oiled up. Yeah, I mean, like any reenactment vehicle, it'll spend 2-3 months not doing anything in the off season, and it's all covered up. I mean, naughtily, I keep it outside. It's got covers on and everything. But I mean, these are reasonably robust vehicles. You know, I'm not for one where vehicles like Pristine, I mean, it's got bits of rust on it. I mean, that can easily come out. It's just superficial. And I don't like to see vehicles all pristine and all looked after. And like, they just, when we do our reenactments, it's, you know, it is what it is. You know, it goes, and, you know, and it could be done up and painted really well and looking immaculate, but it's not that vehicle. You know, and these German vehicles, they would have been through hell and back.
So do you want to tell us about the Northern World War II Association, how people can find you if they're interested?
The Northern World War II Association was set up about 10 years ago now, and got about 350 members at the moment, and we're predominantly based in the north of England. We have members from all over the country. We've got members from London, Birmingham, right up into Scotland as well. So you can go on our website, which is the Northern World War II Association, Northern World War II Association, search that, and you get a list of events, and if everyone wants to join, and we have German units, Russian units, or Soviets, you know, I get in trouble for calling them Russians, the Soviet units. So we have a real lot of units in there, and you can join what you like. And then we all get together and do living history and reenactments. And we have quite a lot of vehicles in the club, and it's just grown and grown. It really has. And, you know, we have our own special effects team, and, you know, we've learned how to, you know, get live firing weapons for reenactments, and, you know, firing blanks, obviously, and you know, and just make them as realistic as possible. And, you know, I think we do some pretty good shows, really.
I've seen you guys a few times at various shows, and it's always been a great day out. Paul, I'd like to thank you for coming on the show. If anyone is interested in seeing any pictures of his half track, I've posted some on the website. That's www2podcast.com. That's all for this episode. I'll have another next month. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can contact me via the website or Facebook. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.